Maximalist Church. My name is Mike Correll. I'm this morning's board rep. We have a variety of announcements about church life and activities. Please read the announcements listed in the order of service. I have a couple of announcements. We're going to start out with Al Haskell, who's going to... Cal.
How much time do I have? If you ordered these, we have them. So by me after the service. Pretty cool, huh?
Brewfest. Great success. Not enough of you were there. Beer was had. Awards were presented. The Pirates won again. We raised about $1,000. Please also give your formal applause to Eric Larson for his undying support. We wouldn't have it without him. Third, as many of you know, the TNA Sausage House Bohica Open is historically held on June 31st, because there is no June 31st, but this year's will be on August 6th. If you're interested, find me after the service. Thank you.
This is a reminder to take a peek at the lost and found table in the social hall and see if there's something on it that has escaped your possession. There will be a meeting about the Heartland Hometown Parade today at 11:45 in Classroom 1. Please join if you would like to help and or participate in an LCUU parade unit. And now Jerry has an announcement.
Jim Hansen and Carlin Wagner would please come to the podium. Jim Hansen.
I think Carlin might be making coffee.
She's making coffee. Please come up here. We have something for you. Morgan has diligently and loyally taken care of the cleaning in this place for what?
5 years?
4 years now? We couldn't have gotten by without her. So the three of us being kind of the committee that she has supposedly responsible to, but then she's been so independent, she's been taking care of everything by herself. We have a gift for her. Church and Unitarian Universalism.
Help yourself to anything that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church, or if you have been visiting for a while and would like information about becoming a member, I'd be happy to talk with you about that. If you are visiting us with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they will go to their religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you'd like to go along and observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just out the doors to my right and across the entryway if there's a need for child care during the service. Classes will end at 11:15, at which time you can pick your child up from their class.
Mike?
Yes?
Sorry. My name is Colin. I'll be doing the little kid activities today. I'm kind of a quieter activity. And Eric Larson is going to be doing soccer or kickball with the older kids. So we won't be having classes today.
Thank you.
Sorry.
We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If any members have brought guests today, we would be pleased if you would introduce them. If any guests have brought themselves and feel comfortable introducing themselves, this would be a good time to do so.
I'm Travis.
I'm Christina.
I'm Christina and I brought my mom Gladys.
I'm Mary and I brought my friend Marie from the church.
Hi.
Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion of the service. Please put your cell phones on silence mode during the service. I hope you find this morning's service fulfilling. This morning's service will be presented by Reverend Dr. Bobby Groth, a UU community minister who has served victims of violence and other injustice issues in the Milwaukee area for more than 20 years. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Alverno College in Milwaukee and a previous guest speaker here at LCUUC. This morning, Dr. Groth will speak about the story behind the story of her recent book, The Incredible Story of Ephraim Newt, Scandal, Bloodshed, and Unitarian Unitarianism on the American Frontier.
Thank you.
story about my great-great-grandfather, and this is him, Ephraim Newt Jr. He was a reverend. He was a Unitarian minister. 156 years ago, he went from Massachusetts, Boston, Massachusetts, to a place called Lawrence, Kansas, to start up a Unitarian church. Now, in that time, have you ever gone to the moon with your family? You ever gone there with your family? No. But it would be pretty empty, wouldn't it? Well, that's kind of like what Kansas was at that time. This is it. No roads, no houses, no farms, no towns, nothing. They were going to have to build everything. And this is how they felt way out there in the prairies, kind of tiny. And so they just kind of got started. The first thing they built were sod houses. Do you know what sod is? It's earth materials. It's grass. And they would get big squares of grass, and they'd put them on a wooden frame. And you'd live kind of in a house that kind of looked like it was made out of grass. Well, after a while, they built log cabins. Now, here's the problem with log cabins. See all those cracks? Got to fill it in with what? Mud. They had to fill it in with mud. So you can imagine, I bet you could wear your muddy shoes in the house there, right? So they did and lived in these log cabins until they built sawmills, which are great big establishments where they can cut logs to make wooden houses. And so this was the town of Lawrence way back there in 1854. You can see it grew really quickly. There were sod houses, there were log cabins, and then when they got their sawmill, which I even saw in this picture, it is right there, ta-da, right on the river. The sawmill, and they started to build regular wooden houses like we know about. So it was really growing pretty good, but they didn't have a church. You want to know where my grandfather preached? This bump is called Mount Oread. And in the prairie, it looked like a mountain. And so he stood right about there on Mount Oread and preached. See him? He's a little bean footer down there. And so he preached outside. Well, that was okay in the middle of the summer, but it started to get cold and rainy. So in the winter, they needed another thing to do. So they decided they moved into Governor Charles Robinson and his wife Sarah's house. They had one of the first wooden houses. And so what they decided was the women and the kids would sit inside the house in the downstairs, and all the men sat out in the yard in their buggies, keeping their horses from running away. And my great-great-grandfather stood on the front porch and preached to the people in the yard and the people in the house. Now, that was really cool, except what? The kids had no Sunday school, did they? Okay. But things were changing in Lawrence. This is a picture of a two-story log cabin, like my great-great-grandfather built way out in the prairie on his claim. I think this might be that house today. I haven't figured it out yet if that's actually it, but it sure does look like it. He said he built a two-story one, and this one's on his claim, or the area that was his claim. This little, you could barely see it, was the house he built in town, right across from the church, and it's still there today. They're rehabbing it now. So things were really changing. He moved from out on the prairie into town, and they started to build a church. The church was built out of stone. It had a tall tower. In the tower was a clock. And that because people didn't really have watches then, especially the people out there on the prairie. And they also put a bell in the church because the bell would ring to tell everybody out on the prairie what time it was. Not just what time it was to come to church, but what time it was during the day. Now, this bell had a very interesting thing, too. They made it in Massachusetts. They put it on a boat. They brought it all the way down the East Coast into the Gulf of Mexico. And then guess what happened? The boat sank. The bell went right to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. And it was down there for most of a year. And somebody finally went down there, got the bell, brought it up, cleaned it off, put it back on a riverboat, sent it out to Kansas. But there were some people in Kansas that really didn't want the Unitarians to have their bell. And so they said that they were going to get anybody who tried to bring that bell in. So one fella, young guy, Billy Hughes was his name, he took the bell off the riverboat. It's about this big, I've seen it. And he put it in a huge barrel of dishes. And he put the dishes all around it, and he put it in kids in Massachusetts brought their pennies to Sunday school and they sent them to Kansas and they bought books for their Sunday school. It was great because the kids now could learn. Well, they just decided they weren't going to stop there. That Sunday school went so well that they decided to start a regular school in the basement of the church because there were no schools. But, you know, it didn't last long. The parents needed their kids to go to school. They needed to read and write. So they started a school in the basement of the Unitarian Church. And then that went so well, they started a college because the kids needed to go to college. Well, by 1866, that college had a building. It grew, and it grew, and it's now the University of Kansas. So that was pretty amazing. That all started in the kind of the basement of the Unitarian Church. Well, here he is, my grandfather. They could really do some cool stuff back then. They built all that stuff. They didn't say, oh my gosh, I can't do that. I can't build a house. I can't build it. They just said, come on, let's do it. Let's figure it out. Well, here he is in 1855 with his wife. And when their boat stopped in New Orleans on their way to Kansas, they had their picture taken. Here he is 20 years later. What happened to him? He got old, didn't he? Yeah, he did. It kind of wore him out being in Kansas. But it's an amazing what people have done and, you know, how much kids really helped with that project in Kansas. So thank you.
Thank you.
Can you join now in the Battle Hymn of the Republic? Julia Ward Howe and her husband, Samuel Gridley Howe, were very ardent abolitionists and very good friends of my great-great-grandfather, Ephraim Newt. They even took several trips to Kansas to see them. Now, one of our sort of family stories about our grandfather was that he was present when Julia Ward Howe had the inspiration to write the Battle Hymn of the Republic. They had been viewing some of the military camps in the Civil War. My great-great-grandfather went on to be a chaplain in the Civil War. And people said to her, oh gosh, can't you write some good words to these awful words to this camp song, you know? And so she came up with really a very cryptic song. And what she's basically saying is that, well, you know, you people, if you think you're Christian, well, Jesus was not about the war. And so if you believe this is a just war to free the slaves, he's going to be watching to make sure you don't go over the line and just become, you know, violent for no reason at all. So when you wonder what these words mean, think about that, where she's saying to them, you really have to, this is not fun to have a war, it's not a good thing, but we have other justice in mind. So let's always remember that. Please do sing the chorus. It's not printed in your order of service, but you probably know it. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Okay?
Thank you.
printed words, and the congregation, if you would read the words in italics. The limits of tyrants. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are people who want crops without plowing up the ground.
They want rain without thunder.
This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Find out what people will submit to, and you have found out the exact amount of injustice which will be imposed upon them. This is the time in our service now when we share our joys and concerns with others in our spiritual community. If you'd like to share your joy or concern, raise your hand. The usher will bring you a microphone. Please tell us your first name and then briefly state your joy or concern. And then I'll light a candle to hold that thought, hold your joy or concern in our thoughts and prayers. I'll light our first memorial candle for the conflicts that are going on in the world today, that we may find a better way.
I'd like you to light a candle of joy for the wonderful bumper stickers we have out in the parking lot. I was reading them in love and peace and coexist, and it just brings joy to one's heart. Thank you.
I have a joy and concern. Last weekend, there was a groundbreaking ceremony for a two-family home in Waukesha for Habitat for Humanity. And my concern is, as the volunteer construction chairman, there's an awful lot of work to do.
I am Al. My joy is that you are all here. I was thinking about doing a phone tree on Saturday. But I want a candle of joy lit for my parents. I spent last weekend with my mom, who turned 80. And it's been a little difficult for them in that mom being now 80, dad 83, transitioning from living on their own into a one of those transitional assisted living areas. Easier for my dad, more difficult for my mom. So a candle of joy that my mom is starting to be able to pull it together with this big transition in her life.
I'm Joanne. A candle for my brother who died earlier this month, and for my family as we continue to grieve.
Hi, I'm Barb. I'd like to light a candle of concern for the latest hugely hit city of Joplin, Missouri, and prayers for all the victims of all these very powerful and destructive statements of nature, and possibly that may raise someone's conscience somewhere. And a candle of joy that I was able to visit with my family in Indianapolis last weekend, just to connect with my dear brothers and sisters and their children, and had a great time.
Hi, I'm Mary. I have both a joy and also a concern. I have a joy that my friends are visiting. I'm so happy to see them. And I have a concern. My father-in-law, Martin Myers, is in the hospital again with colon difficulties, and just don't know when he'll get out.
teachers I've had this year, especially my German teacher and other foreign language teachers who help us as students learn about another way of life and something greater than ourselves.
I'd like to have you light a candle of gratitude and joy for the years of mentoring of my daughter Morgan by all the amazing musicians that have brought her to the place where she is this morning. And first and foremost in mind is my wife. All I managed to do was call the piano tuner when it was time to get the piano tuned, and countless trips to music lessons. But Tracy did all the heavy lifting. And I'm deeply grateful.
My name is Marie-Claude, and I have a great joy today. We were in New York last week for the graduation of our son, Patrick, from NYU. He received a master's degree in social work. And since this is his fourth graduation, I also hope this is the last.
Meditation today is not soothing, but a way for us to remember the lives of those Unitarians who have fought and died to preserve the liberty that allows our faith to exist at all. This is from the Springfield Republican newspaper, which says, "The following letter from Reverend Mr. Newt, who has just returned to Kansas, we find in the Boston Transcript. It is unnecessary for us to say in this community where Mr. N is so well known, that his statements may be relied upon as unadorned facts. Lawrence, Kansas, July 24, 1856. I find affairs in this part of our territory at a very bad pass, far worse than my worst fears. Indeed, I am amazed and horrified at the depths of iniquity to which ruffianism has descended. Up to within 2 miles of Lawrence, the reign of terror is complete. Men are waylaid by guerrilla bands every night and sometimes in broad daylight shot at, beaten, plundered, and left for dead. Houses are burned, horses stolen. This is not the report of rumors, but the testimony of what my own eyes have seen, wounded men and smoking ruins. I find my own house was plundered of almost everything of any value except books, and what was not taken was damaged or destroyed. We had a narrow escape from being robbed, if not killed, as we came in. When within 2 miles of home, we came upon a party of Lawrence men hunting for deadly weapons in the grass by the roadside. It seems that a young man on his way to Lawrence the evening before had been attacked by one of the robber bands there laying in wait, shot at several times, and finally beaten over the head with a revolver until he became senseless, then robbed and left for dead. He had managed to crawl to the next cabin and, though badly bruised, to get to Lawrence that morning and give the alarm. After discharging his revolver, he threw it into the grass that it might not fall into the hands of the robbers. In the search for it, 3 bowie knives were found. Night before last, the house of a Free State settler was burned, and threats were made that 2 more would be burned last night and 1 man shot. In the midst of all this, we have no protection from the United States troops. All they do for us is to take away our weapons, while the civil officers bring in upon us these very highway robbers. Teams have been plundered of provisions, and passengers by the mail coach have had their pockets searched. I am confident that the full enormity of these Kansas outrages is but faintly apprehended at the East for all that has been said, and that a yet darker chapter is to be written in this shameful and horrible history before the end comes. Amen. Will you join me, please, in our centering hymn number 119, Once to Every Soul and Nation. Going on between the anti-slavery settlers who hoped to bring Kansas into the Union as a free state, and the violent pro-slavery insurgents, the border ruffians, who stampeded over from Missouri for the purpose of controlling the ballot boxes, electing a pro-slavery legislature over an anti-slavery population, and terrorizing or killing the abolitionist settlers who might keep that from happening. Now, during his lifetime, grandfather Newt's papers were destroyed by poverty, the natural elements, and war at least three times. Whatever remained at his death was soon lost by his very young family, reduced to penury by his death. That may explain a lot about his disappearance from the annals of our denomination. We are a denomination of the well-educated, and to believe we must read. So for us, though, as a family, his memory was never allowed to die. It was passed down orally by my great-grandma, Mary Bancroft Newt Davis, or Grandma Davis, as we called her. She preserved her father's story, although she was born almost 20 years after his adventures in Kansas. Now, for years after her father's death, my great-grandma Davis said she carried the unpublished manuscripts of his memoirs of Bleeding Kansas and the Civil War. This was at least 600 pages with her wherever she went. At the depths of her own poverty while still a young woman, she said she sold the manuscripts for a mere $25 to the Peabody Library at Harvard, which was his alma mater. The Peabody Library is now a natural history library. The memoirs are not in their collection. Now, my parents tried to find that memoir at Harvard in the 1960s. The university suggested that his papers might have been shipped out to the Meadville Lombard Unitarian Seminary in Chicago, along with the records of other Midwest ministers. Now, at Meadville in the late 1980s, preparing myself for the Unitarian ministry, I was so sure that lost memoir would turn up in the floor-to-ceiling, uncatalogued collection of manuscripts stacked in a side room of the library, waiting for the funds and the patience to be processed. Eventually, everything in that room was processed, organized, cataloged, and dispersed to storage. And although some of the very early handwritten records of his church in Lawrence were found, the manuscripts were not. Now, then in the early 1990s, my brother Bill was transferred to Kansas by his employer. Bill then started to compile new information to see if he could find a basis for any of our many family stories. Now, searching the then embryonic internet, he began writing to various collections around the country for copies of our grandfather's letters that had surfaced. He began to keep a timeline where he entered every document he found into a chronological record. Now then in 2003, I took a sabbatical from frontline domestic violence community ministry, and Bill turned the active part of the project over to me. I shifted my focus then from trying to find the memoirs to trying to reconstruct what was in them. I spent time in Boston so I could access historical collections and wander the Common Garden and other places my great-great-grandfather had known. The first time I passed through those old iron gates to the shade of the historic Harvard campus, I felt gripped by this feeling of, I know this place, I've been here before. And it was in those archives in the Divinity School that I held his original letters in my hands for the very first time. That was quite a powerful experience. A year or so later, I was waiting at an enormous library table in the cool of the Spencer Research Library at the University of Kansas, an institution that Newt was very active in the founding of. One of the staff brought me neat cardboard folders and a pair of white gloves, which I haven't worn since I was 3 years old and in Sunday school, because in the 50s, that's what you wore to Sunday school. I carefully unwrapped file after file and stared at the pictures of Newt's old church, built of stone with a tall front tower that would eventually sport a clock and a booming bell. In one, I could see catty corner across the street to a wood frame house. Later, I would verify with a deed from the county museum that this was the house my great-great-grandfather built in town, convenient to his duties at the church and still standing today. The research has been both exhilarating and frustrating. From having nothing of our great-great-grandfather's papers, we now have over 1,200 documents. I found that many of the original letters that Newt sent to the AUA had been edited and discarded after excerpts were drawn out for publication in the Unitarian Quarterly Journal, which was the official mouthpiece and record of the AUA. Today, the vast majority of his letters are not in any Harvard collection at all, and so the old AUA Quarterly is the only place they exist. When comparing edited text in the Quarterly to the letters we still do have, there was a lot that was taken out before they were published for the Unitarian community. Those letters are now lost forever. Now, in one collection, and this is a really interesting part of history that I found. In one part of a collection, I found a cover letter saying that one of Newt's letters surfaced in the personal effects of a historian after her death. This letter was then sent by relatives back to the collection from which it may not have come in the first place. Now, apparently, in the time before copy machines, researchers took historic manuscripts home to work on, which is another way they could be lost. In another curious instance, I found one half of a letter in the rare manuscript part of a collection and the other half of the same letter in the microfilm part of that collection marked unknown, undated. No one had yet put two and two together to make one complete letter, and it was only after reading all of his letters that I suddenly realized, oh my gosh, this is the end of the letter that I got before. Now, once while in Kansas, I was determined to find Grandfather Newt's claim as I passed through the outskirts of Lawrence. I was way out in the middle of nowhere with a funny map I cobbled together from plat maps on the internet, a county atlas, and a territorial map from the 1850s on which my great-great-grandfather's claim was clearly marked with his name. I found it at the end of a dirt lane. To my left, through the hedge of trees, I could see a structure. It sure looked like it might have once been that two-story log cabin Grandfather Newt wrote of building. To my right, the field spread into the distance, demarcated by crumbling stone walls and tree hedges. I leaned against the rail fence, breathing in that unmistakably Midwest summer breeze that speaks of dried cut hay that went down gritty with dust particles. Here was another place he had stood, fed his chickens, done the back-breaking work of homesteading, lost his all, and nearly died for the sake of liberty and justice and Unitarianism. Now, the words in Grandfather Newt's letters to others and their letters and writings about him were threads that wove together the cloth of bleeding Kansas, the pioneer immigration, the Underground Railroad, abolitionism, chaplaincy in the Civil War, the soldiers' homes of the sanitary commissions of the Civil War, the birth and growth of frontier newspapers, and the origins of higher education in the West. All of these, from within the frame of reference of his life, occurred within a larger context of conflicts within the fledgling Unitarian movement of that time. This was a movement that had at its helm the heart of primitive Christianity, the commitment to living out the love and justice teachings of the long ago Jewish prophet. But the reality for our denomination already was valuing that work more through words than deeds. And so Grandfather Newt's man on the ground, pistol packing, frontier preacher ministry was a real anomaly. Under the grand and glorious sweep of history, I found another subtext. Economic class can preordain the significant actors of any historical age to invisibility and obscurity. This is probably the greatest factor in the disappearance of my great-great-grandfather from our denomination. Newt was a member of one of the oldest families. families in New England, one that came to this country in 1631. But they were farmers and lacked the wealth that would have given Newt the status of a Boston Brahmin, the popular name for the revered and moneyed first families of Boston, so prominent in the early founding and history of this country, as well as the Unitarian and Universalist movements. Now, like them, Newt was a Harvard man, but he entered by way of examination and was supported by scholarship and a job, rather than being handed a family-worn chair. Now, that chair would have gained him entrance to teach in any professional department he chose, or perhaps a call to one of the well-heeled congregations of New England. His old age could have been lived out in comfort and peace, writing and publishing his memoirs, rather than eking out a living in a time without pensions, sometimes reduced to physical labor, even in his 70s. Now, these factors played a huge role in his disappearance. In our denomination, not only have we been more willing to write about justice than to stand knee-deep in the bloodshed, but we have also taken the words of the well-educated, privileged, and wealthy into our mythology and canonized them as the only way to tell our story. Well, cyberspace is an amazing thing, and there were many, many aspects of bringing Newt back into the light that could not have happened until the internet really began to flower. One day, I had just gotten off the phone with my brother, bemoaning the fact that we'd never found another picture of our great-great-grandfather. Within seconds, Bill's email arrived. "Check this out," he wrote. A 19th century lithograph of the young Newt, signature and all, the one that is on your order of service today, had just been posted on eBay. Others were already bidding on it. The seller told how she had found the stained and tattered thing sitting out on a cedar plank table at a flea market in rural New England. His piercing eyes wouldn't let her go. He was an important man, she was certain. This was a lithograph from a series of notable abolitionists. He had to be saved and remembered. So she bought it and put it up on eBay. Now, luckily for us, my brother had a foolproof bidding scheme. And later we found out we were bidding against someone in his congregation in Lawrence. So after I had it restored, I sent them a digital a copy of it so that they could have it too. Now, although in most cases only serendipity has brought them to us again, Newt's life, thoughts, and experiences lost for almost 150 years prior to this research are important to our denomination. They bring a warts and all view of what it struggled with in its youth. The AUA was forged in the moral righteousness of liberal Christianity and yet struggled mightily with moral failing with regard to abolitionism. The Unitarians were in an economic double bind concerning many of their moneyed adherents. Although these well-to-do Unitarians lived in the North and did not hold slaves, they amassed their wealth from industries dependent upon slavery. Now, in the North, they formed the infrastructure of many of the most prosperous and influential congregations. Their wants and needs had to be taken into account within the congregations and by the denomination if those institutions wanted to survive. So abolitionism split this denomination right down the middle, a very different story than our common belief that we stood behind it 100%. Newt, like so many other abolitionist Unitarian preachers, felt forced from his first call because his abolitionism insulted the big givers in his congregation. Now, Newt was a denominational gadfly and very good company with who I call Unitarian Saint Theodore Parker. Parker was a man with whom he originally had deep theological differences, who nevertheless came to his aid and his flagging morale at the heights of the violence in Kansas. Parker read Newt's letters in full to his congregation. He called them the New Epistle of St. Ephraim. And it was to Parker on his deathbed in Italy that Newt went when he fled Kansas and the Harper's Ferry incident of the radical abolitionist John Brown. Now, like Theodore Parker, Newt was blunt and straightforward about the moral imperatives of abolitionism for Unitarian Christianity. He called into question the AUA's self-proclaimed high ground by challenging them on their less than adequate support of the Kansas mission. He got perilously close to exposing to public scrutiny the undercover connections between some of in the Unitarian establishment and the controversial abolitionist John Brown, especially when those connections began to encroach upon what he considered the more legitimate, peace-oriented aims of the Kansas mission, which he felt the AUA was sadly neglecting its commitment to. Now, the relationship between our great-great-grandfather and the militant abolitionist John Brown was one of the mysteries I wanted to uncover with my research. Grandma Davis had always said that our grandfather Newt was at Harper's Ferry with John Brown, but we've never read of him in any history of John Brown's activities. Now, without any personal letters to prove or disprove the story, I did a thorough study of all the Brown family papers, legal testimony, and documents concerning both the state and federal investigations of the incident. I'll let you discover that part in my book, okay? But I bring up his relationship to Brown in order to talk about his theology. Although he was anti-war and anti-violence, like many frontline Unitarians, he was not a pacifist. He did not believe in initiating violence, but neither did he believe in martyring himself to evil by refusing to take up arms when his own, his family's, his friends, or even the lowly slaves' lives were in danger. Although, like all of the Free State Kansas settlers who struggled for their lives, Newt was conflicted about the necessity to use firearms, he did not shrink from the demands of that moral challenge, or from his religious compulsion to fight for his own life in order to fight for the lives of the slaves. Newt, unlike many of his abolitionist contemporaries, including Parker, accepted people of both African and Native American descent as his equals before God, even including them in key positions in his pioneer worship services, a very, very radical act for that time. Grandfather Newt was a unique blend of the universalism in which he had been raised and the Unitarianism to which he was ordained. He would do whatever was needed to meet human needs of those around him, and he was just not willing to die for lofty, abstract principles. Instead, he took up his guns, both a Colt revolver and a Sharps rifle. He joined a militia. He opened his unfinished church basement as a military fort, and once stole a government horse to flee federal captivity when his own life depended upon it. Now, Newt was a challenge to the undenominational denomination. He remained true to his primitive Christianity, which brought him into grave conflict with the financial politics of the struggling AUA. He remained a popular extemporaneous preacher right into his old age, although for over half his working life, he was incapable or unwilling to obtain a full-time call through the AUA, perhaps because of his inability to refrain from sparking controversy even in that liberal venue. Now, the Unitarian story I wanted to tell through my grandfather and his parishioners' lives was how some put their liberal Unitarian beliefs into practice by settling Kansas to make it a free state. There, the horror of a very personal genocide shattered their world and challenged their religious beliefs deeply. The adventures of these frontline Unitarians are compelling not only because they retrieve unknown, important Unitarian martyrs from obscurity, but also because they shine a new light on the study of what has been considered well-known Unitarian history. Those Boston Brahmins received so much attention for their anti-slavery convictions were actually, for the most part, quite insulated from the front lines where the work and the martyrdom and the violence happened. The Reverend Ephraim Newt Jr. was their man on the ground, and it was his and his congregation's letters home that informed and shaped the abolitionist movement in Boston after 1855. They resisted, starved, fought, suffered, and died. But until now, we only remember those who stayed in the East and read frontier letters and wrote about them. These common people's absence from our accepted denominational history has led us to believe that the fight against slavery took place through intellectual arguments on morals and theology, or to imagine that only slaves and soldiers paid with their lives. The story we have not heard loud and clear is the story of the brutality visited upon European Americans, with many, many Unitarians among them, who went to Kansas to insist on its becoming a free state. Now, to me, that's where the Civil War really began. Not in April of 1861 at Fort Sumter in South Carolina, but in 1854 in the Kansas Territory. By doing what they did, Unitarians and others also fought and died for the slaves. Until now, their story and their sacrifices have not been adequately understood or acknowledged for their place in our denomination or history. My hope in uncovering their letters and putting them back before us is that in our time, they will help us find hope and courage for the social action we're called to do now. I am going to save our polylog for the coffee hour because we're running a little late. I will be in there selling and signing books, and I would be very excited to talk to you about anything you think about from the sermon. My great-grandfather was a great admirer of James Russell Lowell's abolitionist poetry. In the last verse of hymn number 150, which we will sing now, he put at the end of a substantial treatise he published on abolitionism in 1849. So please join me in hymn number 150. Please stand as you are willing and able. Thank you. slavery ruffians after leaving Newt's house. When Newt took his sister-in-law to the riverboat to begin her sad journey back to family in the East, he was kidnapped by pro-slavery ruffians. The nation rocked with the news. Everyone from the president of Harvard to Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Theodore Parker, and other abolitionists wrote of their fears that he would be lynched. He managed to escape, and upon arriving back in Lawrence, one of the first letters he answered was from Theodore Parker. These are his words to Theodore Parker on September 14, 1856. "Never did a word of good cheer come to a mortal man more opportunely and with warmer welcome than that contained in your note of the 3rd. I had just escaped from the hands of my enemies, the enemies of government and freedom, with whom I had suffered a fortnight of the most harassing captivity. I mounted a government horse and rode amok through the enemies, going around 50 miles by unfrequented ways, and reached Lawrence that night. I find myself nearly broken down in health, but am fast recruiting and mean to be heard from as far and wide as I can soon. For the greater part of the time, I have been forced to sleep on the bare ground without wholesome or regular food, sometimes in a close, crowded, filthy dungeon into which I was thrown when so sick that I could hardly stand. 3 times I have had every reason to suppose that my last hour had come, both from the intimations of enemies and the warnings of friends. Once I was saved only by a quarrel and a scuffle in which the weapon with which I was to be shot was wrested from the hands of one infuriated ruffian. But enough. I am yet alive, and more alive than ever before, and with a keen sense of the value of freedom, for whose cause I do count all persecutions as an unspeakable gain, and myself truly blessed in being permitted to endure them. I assure you, the confidence that this cause is of the Almighty has sustained me through it all, and my heart has not for a moment failed me. This service is ended. Your service to this, your faith, and these, your community, has just begun. Go forth and let not your heart for a moment fail."